Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Security Ledger Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Security Ledger. Barely a week goes by without some news of a data breach at a major firm, and last week was no different, with credit monitoring firm Equifax acknowledging that information on around 143 million Americans was exposed in an attack on its servers. This week, on the Security Ledger podcast, we'll talk to noted security researcher Robert Hansen about that incident and about Equifax's roundly criticized handling of it. Also, the story on Facebook's role in the shenanigans surrounding the 2016 presidential election took a new turn when the social networking giant released the findings of an internal audit that identified hundreds of accounts responsible for buying thousands of ads that were used to spread fake and misleading stories in the months leading up to the election. In this week's podcast, we'll sit down with Chris Sumner, a researcher at the London-based Online Privacy Foundation, to talk about why social media networks can have a disproportionate effect in shaping the opinions of their users. Finally, moguls like Peter Thiel have long made note of the apparent coincidence between Asperger's syndrome and success in Silicon Valley. Now, a new firm, Aspertise, is looking to harness Asperger's and other autism spectrum disorders to help solve problems in cybersecurity, data analysis, and life sciences. We speak with Frederic Vezon, Aspertise's president, about the hacker Asperger's link and how atypical thinkers can help companies break out of the prison of cognitive bias. But first, Equifax's announcement that it may have exposed information on nearly half the population of the United States to unidentified hackers is just the latest mega breach to roll across the U.S. landscape. To sort it all out, we invited noted security expert and researcher Robert Arsnake Hansen into the studios, who told us that the most unusual thing about Equifax's breach may be the company's curious and bungled response to it. I started off by asking Robert to update us on what we know about the hack, which occurred sometime between May and July.
So far, it is pretty unclear, but we know it's some sort of web vulnerability. And from the people I'm talking to in the underground who have a vested interest in knowing these kinds of things, it seems like it's probably a Struts vulnerability, but that's still unconfirmed. Just based on how their sites are configured and how many of them are, it's fairly likely it was a more traditional web-based vulnerability. And we know from previous attacks that a huge chunk, probably close to half of the vulnerabilities that have led to data breaches have come either through web, and then the other half would be through something like an email or somebody leaving a cell phone in a car somewhere.
Our listeners might be curious. I mean, when we hear about these breaches stemming from attacks or vulnerabilities that have been exploited in a website, how do you go from the initial, let's say, SQL injection vulnerability to pulling away data on 148 million customers?
It really depends on how the sites are configured. Unfortunately, it's not a clear-cut answer. But for the most part, you enable something called XP command shell or something very similar, which gives you command-level execution. But generally speaking, one of the nice pieces about SQL injection from an attacker's perspective is you often don't have to do anything more because the data you're after is right there in the database. And in fact, I've for a long time, I was always confused, like, why do people like SQL injection better than command injection, which gives you everything? And it really comes down to the fact that SQL injection gets you right to the data. You don't have to do any, you know, decompiling any Java or figuring out what operating system you're on or really anything. You just go right for the data.
This is part of a long history of attackers going after data brokers. I'm thinking way back to, you know, the LexisNexis hacks and others like it. Is this just part and parcel of having these companies whose whole purpose is to gather and collect data that they're periodically going to get hacked like this? Or is this evidence of, you know, lax security on the part of a particular vendor?
I think the modern mantra for CISOs is data is no longer, you know, that gold rush that we always thought it was. It's now a huge liability. And in their case, It was both. I mean, they made all of their money on having this information and selling it to banks or whomever needs it, credit card companies or whatever. But at the same time, this could easily be their undoing because they simply just aren't trustworthy anymore. And I think this puts a spotlight on the remaining big companies out there. What are they doing differently? And I bet you they're having some pretty fierce conversations internally right now. I would seriously, if I were sitting inside one of those companies having a similar type of data set, I would certainly be asking some very tough questions from my architecture team, like, okay, give me command level execution on any one of those boxes. Let me see what I can do. And if I can do anything other than, you know, annoy the SOC team with alerts, we've got some problems.
Part of the scandal here isn't just that, you know, information on 143 million accounts leaked, but is also Equifax's response to the leak, which was to set up this website, Equifax Security 2017, which has a good purpose, which is, you know, you can type in some information, figure out if your data was exposed in this incident. That's all well and good. But in the process of doing that, you're also agreeing to this terms of service in which you waive your rights to be part of a class action suit resulting from this breach, and one of those has already been filed.
Yeah.
That seems to have really kicked the hornet's nest in terms of the public reaction to this incident.
Oh, absolutely. I think this is, as someone said it on Twitter, I think it was a master class in how to do a very poor response. And I think I can see why their lawyers would want something like that. They'd want as much indemnification as possible. And you're not giving them something for nothing. You want something in return. That something is, please don't sue us. But the problem is, what you're really saying is, we just took a lot from you, and now we're asking you to do something and give us basically all the rights back that we really don't have. And I don't know if that will stand up in court, by the way. The harsh reality of a judge sitting there and saying there's a class action of 140 million people, 143 million people, who include things like other judges and senators and congressmen, who are all going to be very annoyed when they realize that their information's in there. I don't think that they're going to have much political help in any sort of case or legislation that might be forthcoming.
There was quite a lapse of time between the discovery of this internally and the disclosure of it to the public. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, is there any standard procedure in terms of when you become aware of these and when you should then inform your customers and the public? I mean, my guess is people are willing to give companies a little bit of time to figure out what's going on, but probably not as much time the months that Equifax had here.
Yeah, I have seen breaches go that long before. It does happen, and largely the reason it happens is because the FBI is very often brought in, and they say, please don't speak about this until we have concluded the initial phase of the investigation, which is to at least find out if the attackers are still there, if they're still exfiltrating information, and get some clarity around whether this is somebody they're already aware of or whether this is a new adversary, whether it's a nation state and so on. So that's a fairly standard amount of time, although it does seem a bit weird for someone who's not seen it before. But the way in which they did it was pretty bad. I've not seen people putting up bizarre sounding URLs and making people type in their personal information prior to giving them access to a form that removes their rights. That's a new strange tactic I have not seen before. I will say, you know, there's a typical breach checklist that you need to get through whenever you're doing breach disclosure. And so I've probably only seen it once or twice in all of my years of doing this. But it's basically four things. You need to first say what happened. You need to tell people what happened. You need to tell them there was a breach. Here's how it happened. We were vulnerable on this website, blah, 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 et cetera, right? You have to explain what happened, because otherwise people don't believe that you fixed the problem or that you even fully understand the problem. Number two, you have to say what you have done to fix that problem. So it's like, okay, we have done something. We've implemented some controls. We have done some mitigating something or other or whatever. So it cannot happen again. That issue, maybe some other issue could happen, but that specific one can never happen again. So you give people that sort of, okay, at least you're on top of the issue. Number three, you have to make them whole. You have to do something to give back whatever they have lost. And this is an opportunity to do credit monitoring, for instance, but not then take something away from them again. That's like the exact opposite of what you're trying to do. And then number four, prove to them that you want to continue working with them. Give them some sort of discount or give them some sort of extra, like on top of making them more than whole, like give them sort of the carrot that says, no, we really do care about your business. This cannot, will not happen again. We've changed our internal whatever. It's not possible. And if you don't kind of hit all those four notes, it really sounds like you're hiding stuff. And when I read the breach response, I was, it was pretty, all it basically said is we were compromised and we're sorry. And we do have credit monitoring, but there is that underlying, okay, but yeah, you don't really have it in a way that I want it. So that's pretty bad. That was one of the worst I've ever seen.
Yeah. Hitting none of the right notes, amazingly.
Pretty much.
Natural question to ask a security expert like yourself, you know, if you're one of the 143 million people whose information was in this breach, what should you be thinking or doing now to protect yourself?
Well, there's all kinds of things you can do. Number one, find out if your information's in there or not. If it's not in there, you're good. And unfortunately, that does mean using that incredibly scary website. However, make sure that when you do that, you do not click the enroll button upon the that final stage of yes, you have been compromised. And by the way, I've gone through that flow several times now just to see if it has changed, and it has changed, which is good, because the previous version of it, they didn't even tell you that your information was compromised, so it wasn't clear what you were enrolling to. It just said that, you know, here's an enroll button.
just click it.
Yeah,
dummy,
click,
right?
Click it, which is another reason I think they'll have a very, very difficult time in court, because that is very unclear what's happening there.
I kind of look at this with like the public health perspective. Like, these are kind of like cholera outbreaks or something like that. You know, I mean, they're hugely damaging, even though people don't die from them. But I sort of look at them as things that must be addressable or fixable with, you know, with time and attention and some well-crafted, you know, changes in behavior. Do you see it that way? Or is this not like cholera? Maybe it's more like just, you know, property crime, where, you know, you can reduce it, but never make it go away altogether.
Oh, in terms of cybersecurity or hacking in general, I definitely don't think we can get rid of everything. I don't think there's a cure to security other than a complete lack of privacy. If we were able to make every single person's actions or packets that they send on the internet attributed to their person, their actual human being, then yeah, we could probably get to perfect security. But shy of anything draconian like that, I think it's really, unfortunately, just a capitalist system in that regard. Not that I'm anti-capitalist, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's profit-driven.
Profit-driven,
yeah,
right. And in this particular case, if we see any movement at all from the industry, it'll be because they realize that can submarine the stock and put people in jail and ultimately reduce the trust and customer base if you do get compromised. So that's capitalism at work. They realize, oh, that we could see maybe dozens of people go to jail over this, depending on what happens. That makes people pick up their head and go, oh, maybe we shouldn't do that. You know, actual jail time really makes people think differently about about their IT security.
Robert Hansen, thank you so much for coming in and talking to the Security Ledger. It's always a pleasure.
Anytime, Paul.
Up next, Facebook's revelation that it may have earned $100,000 running misleading and provocative ads for more than 400 bogus accounts with links to Russian actors is just the latest evidence that social networks are the platform of choice for nation states terrorists, and others who wish to push an ideological agenda on the largest audience possible. But what makes a platform like Facebook more valuable than, say, television or radio? Our guest, Chris Sumner of the Online Privacy Foundation, said it's the network's ability to identify personality types who are particularly susceptible to certain kinds of messages. I started by asking Chris to talk about the research project his group conducted.
We looked over six studies with just over 11,000 participants. We looked at how people differed in terms of personality traits, authoritarianism, numeracy or numerical literacy, thinking styles, such as reasoning processes and biases. So we looked at a variety of different aspects. And the study really formed, a part one of a multi-part study. In part one, we wanted to look how people differ. And in part two, we wanted to look at if people had knowledge of how these people differ, how could they be exploited? So we specifically wanted to look at media articles and see how the same issue might be framed in different ways to work on people's biases. So in terms of what we found that people who, as a population, people who voted to leave the EU were higher in authoritarianism. That's a trait essentially associated with, or a disposition rather, associated with more sort of black and white thinking, slightly more dogmatic, less tolerance for out groups, that kind of thing. And on personality traits, we found that Leave voters scored lower in openness to experience, but higher in conscientiousness. And those two traits are highly correlated with authoritarianism, so I guess they go hand in hand.
And when we're talking about conscientious, I think has positive connotations. Somebody who's conscientious is thoughtful and mindful of their responsibilities or what have you. But talk to me about just when we use the term conscientious in this context, what types of predispositions are we talking about?
I guess kind of more a more traditional and conservative way of thinking. But yeah, in some respects, these people are going to be more reliable and, task focused than people who are lower in conscientiousness. If you're relying on somebody to get the job done, you might look for somebody who scores, high in conscientiousness, the sort of the classic sort of completer, finisher type person.
So these are kind of color within the lines type people.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually. The other trait that we found that was interesting was neuroticism played a role in Remain voters as well. Neuroticism is sort of associated with people who are potentially more anxious and a little bit more, I don't want to say worried about the world, but live in a more stressful world because they're essentially open to greater experiences. But we saw quite a reasonable level of neuroticism in Remain voters. So it's quite possible that, people had legitimate concerns about the uncertainty of what would happen with a Brexit vote, which resulted in us seeing higher levels of neuroticism in the Remain population. But nevertheless, I think in terms of personality, it was clear that authoritarianism and the traits that are associated with that played a significant role. In terms of numeracy or numerical literacy, we found that Remain voters as a whole performed much better than Leave voters. These all stem from other areas of research which have found, similar trends when they've looked at Democrats versus Republicans, for example. What we also looked at were cognitive biases. So specifically, we looked at the Dunning-Kruger effect. So
time out. So just for the audience, Dunning-Kruger is the tendency of low ability people to overestimate their abilities and conversely of high ability people to underestimate their own abilities. Is that right?
Yes, that's spot on. So we found that we found that voters on both sides were fairly similarly susceptible to the Dunning-Kruger effect. The worse they did on the numeracy tests, the better they thought they did. But the other aspect we found was that age played a role. So younger people did far better, or were far less susceptible to the Dunning-Kruger effect than older people. We also found that younger people were better at numerical literacy and were less susceptible to impulsive thinking. the next bias we looked at was something called framing, and it's really looking at the choice people make on a particular scenario, depending on how the information is framed, whether it's positively or negatively framed. And again, we found that it was fairly similarly susceptible on both sides. We found that Remain voters were slightly more risk averse in some of the answers. And finally, the final bias we looked at is something called ideologically motivated reasoning. So what we did for the Brexit study is we asked whether immigration increased crime or decreased it. And we found Leave voters were unable to process their numbers if it suggested that immigration decreased crime. And conversely, Remain voters were unable to process the numbers as well if it suggested that immigration increased crime. You know, essentially, in summary, we found definite personality differences between Leave and Remain voters. And they're similar to the personality traits that you would have seen in the US election. We found, you know, by and large, the thinking styles and numerical literacy was better in Remain voters. But at the end of the day, the numerical advantage kind of is all for naught because the biases seem to override people's ability, as a group at least, to interpret a set of numbers that conflict with their, if you like, ideology or previously held beliefs. The next step of the research really was to look at how this knowledge could then be exploited and to some extent whether it was. And that's what led us to looking at psychographic targeting on Facebook, which is essentially using knowledge about people's personality to deliver ads to that particular group of people and tailor those ads so they resonate with that group.
Yeah. Should we conclude from that in around some of these issues that have become over time highly politically charged and polarized, that it is impossible to have a debate about them because you're sort of screaming into the wind of the preconceptions or biases of the people that you're in theory trying to converse with and bring over to your side?
That's a really good question, because at the beginning of the referendum, there was a lot of talk on, you know, UK television about having a meaningful debate about Europe and the UK's place in it. And there have been similar calls for, vigorous debate and discussion about health service in the UK and other similar sort of topics. And I think naively at the beginning of the EU referendum, I thought, well, this will be useful to get all of the facts about the EU, you know, positive and negative, and make an informed decision. But what actually happened was very different from that, and the facts are obviously spun one way or the other. So that's of course, I guess, to be expected in some degree. But what was interesting was, like, it didn't really matter, because yes, the people's beliefs really blinker them to one way of thinking once they've made their mind up. There was a really good paper on this very recently, actually, that looked at where people start. And essentially, people on a particular wedge issue are not that different. You know, so you may, let's say we take the topic of, gun control, for example, and you and I may start in with very, very similar positions, but as an argument resonates with us, maybe speaking to, you know, our personality traits and values, then I might advance one way down the side of a pyramid, and you might begin to advance the other way down the side of a pyramid. And with each of those, you know, we're starting at the top of the pyramid together, very close, and moving down. Now, with each argument kind of reinforces the previous one, and you end up, you know, making your way down and getting ever increasingly polarized on a particular topic. So you can end up in a state where you're really at the bottom of the pyramid, miles apart, although your value system really started fairly close together. And then it becomes harder to bridge that gap. And that's essentially what we've seen on some of the discussions on Brexit and the US has seen. And I guess this is, you know, where you get the terminology of a wedge issue. With Brexit, there were lots of discussion on immigration and on sovereignty. And in the US, I think that the topics of gun control and abortion and immigration are hot button issues in the US too. And those issues have the ability to really drive a wedge between voters. And that's kind of what we're seeing. Or what we've seen in UK politics recently.
Talk about the role that technology and social media are playing, though, in accentuating these kind of underlying features of society in places like the UK and the US.
Well, there's a book called Authoritarianism and the Polarization of American Politics, which does a nice way of describing what the author of it, Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Wheeler, suggest as like a better sorting of politics, not better as in it's a good thing, but better as in things are more sorted now. Republican aligns more with authoritarian positions and Democrat more with non-authoritarian positions, for want of a better description. And where before you had kind of more of a mix in the middle, more of that purple mix in the middle, now the polarization, if you like, has got better sorted. The topics are more aligned with high or low authoritarianism. By shifting people's opinions on various topics, you can get, you know, you're gaining support for those positions, which in turn then, if a political party wanted to, you know, align a policy agenda with those thoughts, it wouldn't be a bad strategy. You know, if I'm thinking about it, for how would I go about driving wedges and creating support and riling the people up so they're more ready to vote for a party of change. I know we're going to talk about Brexit and Trump here, but it could just be the other way around as well. There's no saying that, you know, this couldn't be used to you know, create an outrage about the right-leaning policy items and create a resurgence on the left. You know, it could work that way too, but it would certainly be an additional effective strategy of making that happen.
If increasingly we're inhabiting these online forums of like-minded people that in essence function as echo chambers for our own beliefs and predispositions, but we live in liberal democracies that need the exchange of ideas and the free flow of ideas, and you know, are those two things reconcilable? If increasingly everybody is inhabiting a very small social circle made up of very like-minded people with hardened views.
Yeah, I think there's some research that talks about the benefits of having this cross-pollination, if you like, of low and high authoritarian, you know, to sort of together. There are certainly benefits there, but the separation on the wedge issues, I don't think is healthy for society. It essentially pits people against each other. I don't think that's healthy, essentially. I'm not sure how you tackle that. I mean, other than educating people about, you know, the, if you like, the biases and how opinions are formed and reinforced. You know, I think the more people know about themselves, perhaps you know, that's a way of reducing the problem and accepting that people have differences of you know, of opinion. And I think that sort of education needs to start you know, early in schools. In much the same way as so, you know, if you can make people aware that, yeah, people have got, you know, differences of opinion, but this is how they, you know, they can be, I guess, made harder, then I think that would be a positive step. But right now, I don't see society coming together in the short term. You know, I mean, after Brexit, our prime minister said that there was a sense that the country was coming together. Well, you know, I mean, all the research suggests that that isn't really going to happen, you know, anytime soon.
Okay. I'm 47. How long is this going to take?
just so I can plan.
I just want to plan.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm not far off that age, about 12 months behind you. And I think you and I might both be retired by the time that happens.
Sort it all out. Okay. Well, at least now I know. Hey, Chris Sumner, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to the Security Ledger podcast. It's been great.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Chris Sumner is a research director and co-founder at the Online Privacy Foundation. And finally, legendary Silicon Valley entrepreneur and venture capitalist Peter Thiel has said that many of the successful entrepreneurs he knows, quote, seem to be suffering from a mild form of Asperger's. Far from a disability, Thiel sees the developmental condition as a kind of X factor, a predisposition to creative, independent, and outside-the-box thinking that's needed to succeed in the fast-moving technology industry. In this week's Security Ledger podcast, I speak with Frédéric Vezon about Aspertise, a new consulting firm of and by professionals with Asperger's and other autism spectrum conditions. I started by asking Frédéric to describe what characterizes professionals with Asperger's and autism spectrum disorders. It's a term Vezon took issue with. Individuals with Asperger's don't have a disorder, he says, but they are neurologically atypical.
The way we see it is that atypical people is an actual population. And in any population, you have intelligent people, less intelligent, big, tall, small people, and you have handicapped people and non-handicapped people. It's really a different population that represent right now about 2% of the total world population. And it's not really a disorder. It's a disorder if you put it from the viewpoint of the neurotypical that says, well, it's not reacting like it should be reacting, so there's something wrong here. But when you have people, atypical people amongst themselves, they all act the same. So they become normal in their own environment.
Talk about how the qualities that make them atypical lend themselves to solving technical problems, including problems around cybersecurity.
Well, one of the main issues that you see in technology and a lot in cybersecurity is the cognitive bias, which is basically when you have a group of people working together and they have the same brain structure, they tend to see things the same way. And in technology, and especially in cybersecurity, there's certain things they don't see because it's not obvious to them. When you have an atypical that comes, since he has a different view of the world, he starts seeing things that are less obvious to the group of people. And cybersecurity is exactly that. Finding weaknesses into code and stuff like that is usually because the people that did the code didn't see those weaknesses when they built the code. And this cognitive bias is something that right now large corporations that we work with are very interested in, because that allows them basically to build better code, to see better things in terms of technology. So when you look at, for example, at discovering science, usually the people that do the discovering science is people that see the things differently and find a way to use that thing differently. This difference in brain structure brings people to find different solutions to problems and different way to use to use tools, for example. And that's where atypical brings a lot of value in terms of technology, cybersecurity, and so on. And it is true that in most of the interaction we have had with hackers and people on the fringe, most of them that we've seen are atypical. There are people that view the world differently, so they act differently, basically.
Would you characterize yourself as atypical?
Myself? Yes, I'm atypical. I'm atypical. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You obviously had a very successful career before you started Aspertise, but did you encounter these challenges yourself?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing is that, if you want to take my case, I think I'm a good example because I was diagnosed like a few years ago, right? And all my life, basically, I'm fortunate enough to be very good in certain area like mathematics and physics and stuff like that. So I've been able to go to a high level of study. I did an MBA also. But what was interesting is that from an early age, I learned to interact with neurotypical and I learned to copy basically the neurotypical. So when you see me in a classical environment, you don't see me as an atypical. I'm completely transparent. But inside, I have to almost play a part, play a role in order for me to be able to interact seamlessly with neurotypical. So I learned those things by myself at the beginning when I was young, and I practiced and I was able to do this. At the time, I didn't understand why I had to practice and learn how to talk like a neurotypical, because at the time I didn't know about the difference. But everything came into place when I had the diagnostic, because then I understood why I had to make such an effort for me to be able to really be being understood by neurotypical.
What were some of the things that were hard about you, in for example, in a workplace environment?
I can give you an interesting example. My previous company was in Washington, D.C., about 150 employees. And when you run a company, you need to do management meetings. So I had like maybe 5 or 6 vice presidents. But managing a meeting is complex for us because, for simple things, not when we talk about directly by work, but starting a meeting and finishing a meeting is something very complex. So, for instance, I had to learn how to finish a meeting on a good note for my employees. So I had certain tricks I was using to make sure that when the meeting is finished, it finishes naturally for my employee. But this naturally was not natural to me. So same thing at the beginning when I was very young, I had learned to look into the eyes of the people. Looking into the eyes is not something natural for atypicals. So I had to practice myself when I was talking to people to look into the eyes. Otherwise, my message wasn't going through if I wasn't looking at people in their eyes. This being said, if you look in the eyes of somebody too intensely, that's not working either. You have to find the right spot, right?
Neither too much nor too little, right? It's somewhere in between, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I practice into this and I learned to do it the right way.
Talk about some of the cybersecurity work that you've done on behalf of your customers and where your expertise is there.
As I said before, a lot of hackers and people that look at weaknesses in systems are themselves atypical. So what we offer we can offer different things depending on the client. So it can be as simple as doing an audit in a company, a cybersecurity audit in a company, to a full team of people that will try to be part of the cybersecurity strategy of the company. The atypical approach is that when he looks at a problem, he looks at everything at once. He goes into a level of detail that's not usual and looks at everything at once, and he goes above what is being asked for of him. So basically he says, you have to solve this or do this software. He will think about stuff that are not part of the initial process, but are bringing a lot of value to the process. So that's typical. So what we do is basically this. So we bring teams we can do audits. So we do pen testing, of course. One thing we have also is that we have a very strong relationship with certain networks of people. We would call them hackers networks, because we have a lot of atypical that are close to us or work with us that are part of those groups. So when we work with a company, we're also able to see in advance a little bit what's coming and help them being prepared before it comes.
There's a little bit of a stereotype in the technology field that folks who are atypical, that you say, maybe they're Asperger's or on the autism spectrum, are super productive. They're the 10x producers in terms of the amount of code that they can create and the quality of the code and so on. Is that, in your experience, is that true? Or is the value, as you say, more that they are people who are outside the box thinkers? So it's the perspective they bring, not necessarily that they're super producers.
When you manage a company, you work as a manager is to tell people you have to work, basically, is to make people work. In an atypical company, it's the reverse. You have to make people stop working. The atypical has a capacity to get focused into something and forget everything else. So, yes, if you put an atypical onto a subject and he starts working on a subject, it's not so much that he's faster, but he's going to be so into that subject then. He can work for days without stopping, basically, on that subject. And some companies have used that in the past to be, a little bit faster and so on. The problem is that when you do that, you basically burn the person.
Right.
And that's the danger of using that technique. So are they more productive? Yes, they can be more productive. But it has to be controlled in a controlled environment so you don't burn the person. And at the end, you create more damage than goods. So, yes, they can be very productive. There is something we call hyperfocus, which is one of the characteristics of atypical, which is basically when an atypical is focused on something, sometimes it can be so focused and everything else disappear, and even the notion of time disappear. So that's one of the characteristics, but obviously we're not selling that characteristic because it's, I would say, dangerous characteristic. We have people that came to us that left their work, so they resigned, and what they told us was that since they were very good at certain things, the manager was giving them more and more and more. And the atypical usually doesn't say no and goes for it. And basically at one point, those guys either burn out or they say, no, I'm quitting because that doesn't make any sense to continue at this pace. And that's why it's so important to be able to manage correctly atypicals in order to get the value of atypicals.
So you are an atypical person, and now you're working with a lot of other people who have a similar background to you. Have you learned anything or had any insights into your own personality or the way you work as a result of that?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely, yes. What I discovered, first of all, is that, as I said at the beginning, it's a population. So most of the atypical feel they are the only one like they are, and then, you know, they feel, you know, they don't feel good about, you know, their specificity. But when they realize that there's a whole lot, millions of people like them, that change a little bit the perspective. What I realized that was interesting is that, and that was the beginning of the company, one thing I wanted to check is that, you know, usually when you have a team of people in technology, what do you create team? Because you create synergies between people, and that synergies brings a lot of value. The question I had at the beginning was that, okay, that's great for neurotypical to have, you know, those synergies, but what about atypical? Can they actually work together? Can they communicate clearly? And can they create those synergies? And what I realized is that team of atypicals actually create those synergies, like team of neurotypical, but it's a different type of synergies, but they do create synergies, and they do work together as a team, and they do communicate very well amongst each other. So that was really an enlightenment for my part, saying that, you know what, it's basically, if you put them in an environment where they can work naturally with their peers, you're going to have great value for the rest of the, you know, for the technology, for the community, whatever, you're going to have great value. But, and I also seen that you don't necessarily need to play a role to be efficient when you're in the right environment. And that makes all the difference for people like me, basically saying, okay, I can be natural in my way to work, in the way I work, and be efficient because I'm in the right environment vis-a-vis my demeanor, basically, the way I interact with people.
Frédéric Vezon, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to the Security Ledger podcast. We loved having you.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.